Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm a theologian by trade, having traveled a little bit in my life, and apologetics is at the very heart of what I'm doing and living for and try to practice. I've been a pastor for 10 years in a local church in Kristiansand in Norway, and that was a very exciting experience. I loved it. Right now I'm full-time at school at Gimlekollen, and we train especially young communicators, young Christian communicators, like youth pastors, and help them integrate the apologetics into their thinking, the perspectives, and their preaching, which is absolutely a big challenge. I'm teaching. My most of my time is on the course called Communication and Worldviews at this school. It's a privately owned school, and in Norway we're so fortunate to have state funding even for private schools. So 80% is funded from the state, the rest we have to bring in, which is quite a challenge anyway, but it gives us really good opportunities to give what we think are very important perspectives into the academic world. So we give credits, we give bachelor degrees that are internationally accepted. And actually, we give credits here at the conference. If you attend our post-forum seminar on Thursday, Peter S. Williams is going to be teaching there, especially on the existence of God, the arguments for the existence of God, arguments for the resurrection, which is kind of basic for one of our courses. If you do that, you can join our course and get 10 credits into the system, which is quite an amazing opportunity for us, being kind of a Norwegian. Then this European network is bringing us into bigger context, giving us new resources, bringing us to new contacts, challenging our thinking on all fields. So this is very exciting for us. I was brought up as a Christian, so I didn't become a Christian either by apologetics or by evangelism, but by my family. My parents were missionaries. I grew up in Africa and in boarding school. It would be another story. But when I was young, I had a different kind of Christian work and made commitments. I heard the story of Jesus, made a big impression on me. Did this really happen? And of course, it did happen. And if you understand, just telling the story, especially remember, even as a child at this boarding school, they were showing some really boring pictures this slideshow where you turn the slide film like this. When I was young, this was how we did it. And she was reading the story of Jesus suffering, and there he was in Gethsemane and to the cross. It was very simple. It was not very much emotion, but this really touched me. And I can remember it even today, that this really happened. This is something big. And it made an impression. And later I had to make a commitment. That was kind of brought up when I was getting a little older. You need to make a commitment. Where do you stand? Jesus calls you to commit. So that was a big step for me. And then growing a little more in high school, we had a summer house where some hippies were living in the 70s. They were still living hippies. Very interesting. And you're a missionary. That's interesting. And you know, come and see this. I have a special dictionary here. And you say, well, look at this. The Christian view of women. Oh, they were discussing whether women had souls in 300. And Jesus would kind of made God around 300. This was a socialist, a very skeptical kind of dictionary. These were very new ideas to me. I never heard it, but really challenged my faith. I need to know, is this true? And then I went to Bible school, which is not kind of accredited, but kind of 1 year investing in understanding the Bible, and that really made a difference, because that was the one school in Norway that had a teacher that was an apologist. And just 2 weeks before I left home, my father died. So that was a big thing for me and my family. But that year, one of my big concerns was existential and it was intellectual. Did Jesus really rise from the dead? That is the big question. If we have an answer to that question, well, everything else will fall into place. And I was, well, I believe Jesus was the Son of God, that he risen from the dead, but I never imagined that could be given historical arguments for it that are really, really convincing. And that's been really fueling me and driving my concern that Christians should know that, well, their faith rests on solid, just historical facts and solid grounds. So Christians, they have their commitments, but they haven't really asked the big questions. So this is one of my big concerns for Christians and also, of course, non-Christians. And when I bring messages to non-Christians in some context, I always say, well, if you really find out that Jesus never rose from the dead, please come and tell me. Because I don't want to do this if it's not true. And actually, the Bible tells me so. Paul says, if Jesus is not risen, we are liars. Christian faith is fake. It's empty. So it's because it's true, and actually there are very good reasons to believe it is true. So I've been traveling a little bit. I've been teaching at Bible colleges. I've been teaching in Kenya for a couple of years, training pastors. I've been a pastor for some years, and now I'm teaching full-time at Gimler Collins School of Journalism and Communication. Right now, I'm doing a course not for Christian communicators. That is, Christian communicators is my main group. But now I'm teaching journalists a course that's called Media, Ethics, and Worldviews. And you know, when they know that you're a conservative pastor from town coming to teach them ethics, you have all their suspicion. God says you shouldn't be like this. You shouldn't be like this. Or moralistic, negative. So it brings all the kind of worst assumptions with them. So it's really a big job winning them over to listening. And so when we teach them ethics, we teach them worldview thinking first, because the way you view ethics depends on the way you view the universe and you see human beings. These things belong together. And these journalists are very often one of the really superficial, well, at least from what they're writing, superficial people writing up about these are happening actions. It's supposed to be exciting and it's supposed to be relevant, up to date. But the deeper thinking, the deeper questions is lacking. So we want to push them the deeper questions. So one of the highlights was just this week when we go through a book by James Sire, you might know that, The Universe Next Door, a list or a worldview catalog, 10 worldviews. And when I come to nihilism, it's one of my favorites because I quote Nietzsche, the madman of Nietzsche, say, God is dead, God is dead. Who has killed him? We have. How can we do this? So, and I try to point out, what is he really saying there? He's not only attacking theology, he's attacking humanism and all the values we've been teaching you is the basis for journalism, respect for human beings, truth, and so on. But what do you respond? Do you agree with him that there are no real objective values, that morality is basically power game? And you know, they're very postmodern. They don't really have an answer, but they're very sure about what Christians are doing wrong. They know that is wrong, But, you know, very little Norwegian students are often a little bit shy as well, so they might be thinking something, but the only response I got from them, they should be thinking, students, was, well, do you have an answer to Nietzsche? Because if you don't, well, there's no basis for anything. No basis for democracy, human rights, or anything. The only response I got was, well, nihilism. Well, that's his opinion. That is interesting. Mm-hmm. I find it so interesting to listen to the postmodern thinking, but at least we try to challenge them. So they cannot say that I'm doing evangelism, because I'm bringing also nihilism, trying to present it as kind of attractive as I can to make the challenge clear. And of course, this would be probably the first time most of them have ever heard Christianity presented in an intellectually credible way. Well, this is what we believe, and there are good reasons. Come and challenge us. But we've already presented the other worldviews and said, well, these are the reasons people believe this. And all worldviews have their challenges. Yes, let's go on to the topic. Even the teaching on worldview and ethics has a kind of an apologetic purpose for us. It's pre-evangelism, forcing people to think the big questions, ask the big questions, so that they can think clearly. And when they have the right questions, the Christian answers suddenly start to give meaning. Because the Christian answers don't give meaning to most of the secular young people. And to do apologetics, we need to be on the challenging and asking side as well. That's one of the tasks I think we need to take seriously. Okay? Let's follow the schedule, of course. We've been asked to write these schedules so that you can follow. And if you have a challenge with language, with my Norwegian English, or with English in general, the sheet might be helping you. Okay? Some simple things about apologetics, what it is. The word apologetics means defending the faith. One of the big misunderstandings in the Norwegian context is defense is a military move. Someone attacking you and you hit them back. Actually, the best thing is hitting them first, right? So apologetics is seen as a very aggressive way of approaching people. And Christians don't like being seen as aggressive. Being kind of defending the faith sounds also very defensive, of course. So say, well, stop this kind of defending thing. It sounds like you really have something to defend and makes you unpleasant to be with. But the meaning of the word is not from the battlefield. The word apologia means giving a word back, not a fist back, right? Giving a word back. Logia or logos is the Greek word for word. And apologia means a word in return, a word back. And it really starts from the presupposition that there has been a question already or a claim already. Christians are stupid. Jesus never lived. Dead men can't rise from the dead. There is no God. And what are you going to do as a Christian? Are you just going to stand there? Or are you going to give a word back? Of course you have to give a word back. You have to respond to the claims, the questions and objections you meet. So if we understand what the word apologetics means, it is more obviously relevant and necessary for a Christian to engage in it. It's not the battlefield. Actually, its technical uses comes from the court. You're brought to the court. Well, this person is is kind of staging riots. He's a political problem to us. That's a category. It's a claim. It's a category of a crime. And then he must speak in his defense. He needs to reply to this accusation. And Christians need to reply to accusations about their faith. It's from the court of law, and it's become kind of the general word as well about responding, not only when you're in court, but when people claim some things and have objections, you respond to these objections. And of course, it is very important or helpful for us to remind ourselves when we get these objections, we're not on the battlefield. Or when we think apologetics, it's not battling or hitting them or get them down, get the enemy down. But it's about arguing, giving good reason, behaving well, right? You have a jury listening to you. You have a judge, and you are to reason, present your case. You can use your emotions. You can be emotional as a lawyer, you know. But it should always be reasonable, and you should show the evidence. In the battlefield, you don't have time for evidence. You don't use words, you use bullets, bombs, right? And you use smoke screens. If you're a good lawyer, a genuine lawyer, you should be open to the truth. Bring me the truth. I'll present you the truth. That's not, of course, always how lawyers are perceived. You've maybe seen the film Liar, Liar. Very interesting, the role of lawyers. But the ideal of a lawyer is someone giving a good argument for his case, pointing to relevant evidence. And then the judge and the jury, they have to weigh different arguments. And you're not the judge. You're not allowed to give the conclusion. They must do it. And that is a very different way of communicating from many pastors and young people see it, because you're there to convert people. Lots of emotion, come forward, you convert to Jesus here. I give you the answer, you make a decision, you come here, you're in control. Apologetics is not of controlling people, force them, or hypnotizing them to make a decision, but presenting them with the evidence, responding to questions. It's also a branch of theology, like, you know, missiology is the study of missions, how you do missions, and missiology has many different areas of cultural studies, social studies, of psychology. All these fields are relevant to missiology, right? How do you really do this? How can we make, can we think in the correct way of about mission? And of course, missiology also needs the Bible, biblical thinking, theology, so on. And it's apologetics is a very parallel to missiology as a branch, because apologetics is not just one narrow field, but like missiology, it's of everything. It's about, we're going to see, God clearing his name. We see that from the whole start of the Bible. Like you see the mission of God, if you've read the book by Chris Wright, about mission, several books, it's really, really helpful to see the big picture of God's mission to the world, of even from Abraham, was God's mission to a world running away from him, and then bringing in you a new family, a new person, to obedience, to show the justice of God, representing God to the world, and that's what we are called to as well as disciples in the New Testament. God's mission. And you can see this even also if you go through the Bible, you can see it from the start of the Bible. You know, what really happened in the garden was that the two first human beings was presented with a lie or a distortion of the truth. It's very, very intelligent and psychologically relevant. Truth by Satan, by the snake, was distorted, and they saw and they chose, and then everything was disfigured. Everything was changed. So, beginning with a lie, and then what you see when God meets them, they are hiding, they're afraid of God. Why should they be afraid of God? Something emotional has gone really wrong. Like in a marriage, when you suddenly get afraid from the other one. Something really deeply wrong with us. And they saw they were naked. So even from one another, they were afraid and ashamed from God. And then God challenged, what have you done? Have you eaten? And it's so interesting. Well, Adam, she told me, she said. So he's running from the blame. And what is Eve doing? Saying, well, the snake, right? So there's something wrong being done, and they're blaming someone else. They're running from what they've done, the responsibility, pointing somewhere else. And if God had allowed the snake to speak, what have you done? Well, you created me, God. And that's one of the big themes in the Bible. You see a world that's been ruined by sin, and we're running away from our responsibility. That's part of our story of who we are. And the big problem for God is that we're pushing the blame on Him. Of course, we find scapegoats in our own world as well. In politics in Norway, we have these, oh, it's immigration, or it's lazy people, or it's this or that. We find scapegoats, which is a very dangerous thing culturally. But also you see theologically, people blame God. How can they? That's one of the biggest questions you'll get as a Christian. How can you believe in a good God in this world? Looking at the news one day will really disprove the possibility of existing a good, all-powerful, loving God. And that is a big, big problem for God. How can we trust Him looking at this world? And you know the one. You know what we experienced in Norway a couple of years ago with Anders Behring Breivik, the killer who came and killed young people on a camp belonging to the Labour Party, completely innocent. One of the very serious things about what he did was, one of them, is that he dressed as a policeman. He said, I'm a policeman, come up here. You've heard there's been an explosion at the building in Oslo. He came to this island. I'm a policeman. So people came up to him, oh, I thought you were a stranger. And then he killed them off, cold-bloodedly. So when these people were running, they didn't know who they were running from. But some of them saw him killing. So policeman killing someone else. And then they were running, they were swimming, and coming ashore. And what did they see? Policemen. Completely confused. What's going to happen now? Are these all going to kill me? Right? If you cannot trust God, and people representing God, the religions, are people that do evil, how can we trust Him? And if we individually also blaming God for our own pain, for our own illnesses, for our own misery, how can we trust Him? So, you know, one of the central prayers of the Lord's Prayer is, hallowed be your name. Is that the version of even the present prayer? Hallowed isn't very English, is it? Or up to date? Is there any?
We still tend to use
Okay, yes. We have a new translation in Norwegian, which has changed the word, but that the Lord's name is holy. To be able to trust Him and want to trust Him, you need to be seen as holy and just and good and loving. You know? And the world we see is really smearing His name. Which means the Bible is partly written to clear God's name from a world running from a responsibility and saying, well, it's your blame, God. You made this mess. How can you accept this And even the prophets in the Old Testament say, oh God, how can you look at this violence, this evil? You make me see it, but how can your holy eyes accept this? The blame is pushed on God. We assume God is involved. He can't be trusted. And that will really make it so hard for anyone to start to want to relate to God, of course. Your name, clearing God's name is one of the big topics of the Bible, even from the start. People blaming God, God clearing his name. And that's one of our jobs. Not jump him in front of God, saving him from all the enemies trying to attack him. Because God is not afraid of being attacked. You can't harm God. You can't kill God. But you can smear his name. And every one of us does when we sin, right? It's not only people we step on. God's name is being smeared. And people have a hard time trusting you and then trusting who you represent, trusting God. Clearing his name is one of the big topics in the Old Testament, which links into apologetics. God is the apologist who's being blamed by a world. And how... what are we going to do? We are his ambassadors, we are witnesses, we are his disciples, and we're also his apologists, clearing his name for the accusations. In the New Testament, we see that one of the big broad lines of thinking is the gospel challenging the authorities. You know, some people think that the gospel is about, yeah, God loves you. There is a God, and he's really very kind. This is kind of modern, democratic view of God. And don't you want to believe in God? Well, maybe not. But he's good. He could be good for you, just like buying the latest product of any kind of thing. But that is not really what the gospel is about. The gospel is something that is challenging our ultimate commitments. You know, the oldest creed of the New Testament is Jesus is Lord. The two words, Jesus, Lord. Which means that Jesus is challenging all your ultimate commitment. He's challenging Caesar. Caesar is Lord. Caesar is the ultimate ruler. But the Christian said, Jesus is the ultimate ruler. So one of the challenges the first Christians had to relate to is the claim by Roman authority, the suspicion that they were really politically kind of unreliable. They were setting up some new political ideas and illoyal to authorities. So you find a big stress in the New Testament, many letters and writings, especially in Luke, that shows that it's not the Christians that are making these unrest and problems. Christians are really presenting the gospel, presenting Jesus as a challenge, but the unrest, the problems are created by people who attack the Christians. You see the letters of Peter and Paul. Pray for the leaders, pray for authorities, pray for, And that part of that background is the fear by the Roman authority that this is kind of political instigation of some new kind of system. Okay? In the New Testament, the gospel is something that challenges you. It's not a product you can add on to what you already have. Your ultimate commitments are challenged. You cannot stay the same. And in the New Testament, you see that the word of message or proclamation, the kerygma, which really means a message from the battlefield telling that your king has won the battle. The story about something that's happened, that's good news. That's the evangelion for us, the good news for us. This message that something has happened always has to be assisted or supplied with apologia. There's a message. Jesus is the Messiah. Oh, how so? He was crucified. Well, you give the argument. You see from the Old Testament that that's exactly what's going to be happen. And he didn't die for his own sin. He was raised from the dead. God clearing his name. God showing that Jesus is the answer, is the Messiah and his son. So in the New Testament, the message, the story about Jesus, always go hand in hand with explaining it and defending it. You see this modeled in the apostles, in the Acts of the Apostles, preaching for the Jewish audience. When you look at the sermons in Acts, you see actually reasoning. You see the general way you see preaching is, well, you have the Old Testament telling a story of the Jewish people, and what happened with Jesus was a fulfillment of this. It's an argument that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. That is a very strong argument. If you believe the Old Testament, that is a really, really big thing. So that went well with a Christian audience. Now we have one of two speeches actually in the New Testament written for or spoken to non-Christians. And it's in Lystra and in Acts 13, and the more fuller speech we see in Acts 17. And Acts 17, I think, is what you have on your seat, isn't it? By my colleague Lars Dahler, who did his PhD on Acts 17. And that's been very important for our thinking about the apologetics, trying to go back to the biblical roots. We don't just want to be kind of traditional. What the church has always done is probably the right thing. Or do not want to be just modern. This is the most efficient way of doing things. We want to make sure that we have a biblical basis for doing things. Because sometimes the most efficient thing could be just manipulation. That's a much more effective way of building a church if you think of an organization. And manipulate people into this, and you're going to see a lot more people coming in. But is it the right way? And we think we need to be looking at these models, and you're going to do that later. You're going to see how Paul is really arguing. He cannot use the Old Testament, because Old Testament is not, they don't understand it, and it doesn't give any meaning. And it's really, if he points to the Old Testament, it will really make him irrelevant to the context. Just showing he doesn't belong there. He belongs in Palestine, in Israel. He's a Jew. And that is really a challenge for us when we argue to modern or postmodern people. What arguments are we using? We want to use the Bible. We believe the Bible. And we use Bible verses. If you use Bible verses to secular people, it just shows how narrow-minded you are. You come from a different place. This is not for me. Paul is actually using the very same content of his argument, pointed to Jesus' resurrection as the point of the story. But he's not using the Old Testament, he's using Athenian or Greek poets, pagan poems, which is really amazing for a Pharisee. We're going to study that a little bit later. And just to make sure I'm clinching the kind of the biblical basis for this, we could have said so much more on this. You have the in B4, on page number 2, Peter's exhortation, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you, to give a reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. We could have said a lot about that, but I do think we should leave that to later. What's he really saying there? What's the context of it? What does it mean in practice? And we did have the half of the last sentence, but do this with gentleness and respect, not just about the content, but the way we do it is important as well in apologetics. Okay, let me just suggest a definition, which is the one kind of last developed in his PhD work on Acts 17, which is not very different from the general definitions you will find other places, but I think it can be helpful. But please bring your own views and suggested definitions. and we would like to learn about this, okay? Apologetics is the rational justification, which means apologetics is about thinking critically. It's a rational activity. There are many other things that are important to us. You know, emotions is important to us in the Christian faith as well, but apologetics mainly focus on the rational side. That's where we're working. And rational justification is a way of arguing a position, of giving grounds for what you claim. Okay? The rational justification is a special focus for apologetics. You know, theology is understanding the truth of the Bible, that God has revealed, and who God is. Apologetics has to do with that, but it's concerned with how can we give a good reason for thinking that is true. So apologetics is kind of a helping discipline for theology. The rational justification of Christian truth claims. Well, for us that would be quite obvious. You justify the Christian truth claims. However, in the age we are living in, and even the Christian church, they don't believe in objective truth, it seems, anymore. So when you say, well, my truth claims, they would say, yeah, your truth claims. You, Nietzsche, he has his view, I have my view, Christianity has his own, its view, and then Hinduism has its view. So what's true for you is true for you. If you believe in God, he exists for you. That was a response I got from the journalism students. So what do they believe? Is God dead? Did he live and die? That doesn't give any meaning if you think about what God is supposed to be like. But they were thinking, God exists for those who believe in him. Truth is what you believe in. Truth is subjective. So when people come to churches, they don't come there because they believe there's truth there. But because there's something good for me. Maybe I get some comfort, fear from death, get company, fellowship, good values. It is the church's values. It's one perspective. What is so hard to communicate and get across is we actually claim that God exists independent of your opinion. That Jesus rose from the dead. It actually happened. And Jesus is Lord, whether you admit it or not. If people understand that point, they will bring the questions. But as long as they see Christianity inside what we call the modern or postmodern perspective, they will see, well, it's just Christian truths. What we claim is truth, plain and simple, and true whether you believe it or not. Of course, it's important for people to believe it, okay? The rational justification of, maybe we would say, central Christian truth claims. I would think it's important to focus on basic Christian truth claims, like, you know, C.S. Lewis writing Mere Christianity, that we should be, apologetics should be concerned about the big questions of who God is, did Jesus live, and so on, and how can we get good arguments for the Christian faith and not be kind of infighting of baptism or might be important questions. So that shouldn't be the focus of our apologetics endeavor, especially not in these times. Okay? And Christian truth claims are always met, if they're understood, with questions, objections. People ask questions, that's a very good opportunity for explaining what you really mean, because it's so hard to get across the Christian message. And one of the big problems is that people assume they already know what you believe in, so they don't ask you. Now, we're coming to a new generation from the Norwegian school that's normally been Christian school, but now it's become pluralistic teaching. So at last, students, the young people, are asking the big questions. What do Christians really believe? We don't know. That gives us a big opportunity. The former generation, they thought they know what Christianity was about, and that was boring. Don't tell me anything. I don't have any questions to you. Just know how it's going to, I'm going to be bored about it. Okay? So Christianity is responding to questions. Objections is, of course, if you already have a position, you object. That cannot be so. Miracles cannot happen, or yeah, you have a position and then you object. And people who are really thinking would normally object to what we claim. And that we should welcome it. We'll probably hear about that later, I guess. That we should be welcoming, and maybe rather than looking at the pastor as a model of preaching or communicating. You see, he's preaching. I love being a pastor and preaching the word of God. But he's speaking and you shut up. And after he's been preaching, you should pray. Mm-hmm. That's not how the apologist should be working. Right? Should rather be like Jesus. He gets a question, then he asks a question back. And then you need to change the question. Your perspective is changed. If we try to rather listen to Jesus than Socrates in a way of thinking about communication, I think that would help our communication and apologetics quite a bit. Okay, and point four, we need to move on. In order to establish the epistemic permission and the epistemic obligation of the Christian faith. Well, these are technical terms. I don't want to excuse technical terms. This is quite helpful because there are two different things we need to do in apologetics. We need to point out that, well, the Christian faith is one possible position. If it's okay to believe in something, if it's okay to be a New Ager or an atheist, you should be allowed to be a Christian as well. Christianity is one of the relevant options in a pluralistic society. And that is a big, we need to argue very hard for that these days. And you see, especially in the secular press, that you're so tolerant, but don't bring anything up of this. And actually the teaching of our journalists, we try to show them that religion in many aspects has been a blind spot. We're supposed to bring facts. The religion is kind of making us subjective and bringing up all these problems. But you need to bring up what is important to people. And you need to be, and these things are relevant. And the Christian perspective is one of the relevant perspectives. That is a big job, just to show that Christianity, well, that's one of the options. Although I find when I teach the worldviews, people are a lot more interested in New Age, even nihilism. When we get to Christianity, this is super choppy, so, well, familiar. So they have this kind of secular blinders, and it's a kind of post-Christian condition. People are immunized. They know enough about Christianity just to know it's not relevant. So just to put Christianity back as an option is one of the tasks we need to do. Well, we're here. We need to have a voice in the public arena, in all arenas, in the media. We need to be there. But then one of my friend Lars's arguments is the apologetics should be more than that. We should argue that this is not only one option, but it is reliable, it's true, it's truer than the other alternatives. Not just claiming it, but showing it, of course. So two levels of, well, we're one position, and this is a legitimate position. What we should say, well, you should actually believe it, because it really happened. God really exists, and so on. Okay? And then point five, it's for both Christians and non-Christians. One of the perceptions in my church is that apologetics, well, if you get hold of an atheist, that's what you bring up. You argue about God's existence. Maybe apologetics can help us a little bit. But inside the church, well, we need Jesus and preaching and so on. But what Lars has pointed out and what you see in the New Testament is it's very important for people who already believe to know this is reliable. You know, from the introduction of Luke's gospel, this is written so that you should know it's reliable what you have believed. It is reliable. It's based on good reason and truth. So Christians need to know that. And from my experience, the Christian, even the committed ones, they don't know. And you see people going to Bible colleges, very enthusiastic, and they've seen kind of supernatural things, a lot of prayer, charismatic things, and then they come back to school and they start to study, well, existence of God. I'm not really sure. So if you live as a Christian, Holy Spirit and many experiences, and then, well, does he really exist? You have a big problem. And a close friend of mine, young friend of mine, was going to study engineering and the sciences. And he really was not helped at all from the Bible school to deal with these questions. So if he wouldn't have come into contact with some of our networks, he would probably have been either kind of very passive Christian or a non-Christian by the end of his studies. The Christians don't know. There is a good reason. It is. They need to know as well. So I am very enthusiastic about being a preacher and a pastor who brings in apologetics in every area, not just leaving it to the evangelists to meet the atheists, but bring in atheists' claim into a sermon. What do the atheists say about this? Well, you're going to hear it in the workplace. Anyway, let me, as a preacher and Christian thinker, think through the claims and show how to understand, how to meet it, and what the Bible says about it. The need for apologetics in Europe, there are three. The first, the challenge of the context. To do apologetics and mission, you need to know the context. When we were in Kenya as missionaries, we need to learn the language. I was teaching at the pastor's training college, and I didn't really know to know Swahili very well, because all the teaching was supposed to be in English. But we did get 3 months of Swahili, and it is just a wonderful language. You can learn something in 3 months. But if you're going to really do studies, you will have to understand the culture and the language properly. So we only stayed there for a short time. But if we're going to do apologetics in Europe, one of the important challenges for us is making sure we understand the challenge. And sometimes you see the discussion, what's really the challenge is defining how you deal with it. And some of the really unhelpful ways of doing it, doing apologetics and preaching in church, comes from a wrong or unbalanced analysis of the situation. For example, you have some parts of the church who say, well, we now live in a postmodern time. People don't believe in truth anymore. It's relationships. Let's become relational. And of course, actually, we should learn about this. We should integrate it in the way we are thinking and relating to young people. But there might be something we haven't really seen yet. So how do you understand the context? It needs to be done properly. And I just want to give you three tools on point B here. Three tools or ways of analysis to make sure we get the big picture right. So the first tool is theology, and making sure we have the theology right. And theology tells us, well, we still, God hasn't changed. The Bible hasn't changed. Human beings haven't changed. So there is something that's still there. We can know what it is. But the modern world has changed. The Christians have changed. The way people are thinking have changed. So we need to adapt to the challenges we are at. There's something still that's solid, and something has changed. And if we go from theology to the other tool of sociology of knowledge, sociological processes shaping our world, I think Ozgin is one of the very, very helpful thinkers who brings in sociology, and especially sociology of knowledge, to help us think, how the world is shaping our thinking. And we can just point to some very important processes which we are all influenced by, the globalization, that we immediately are influenced by things happening in other parts of the world. And people on the internet, on movies, everywhere, they're influenced by the ideas across the world. And one of the big global influences is academia, the universities. And they're, of course, spreading there to a very high degree secularism. You have the media, global. Are they spreading the good news? No, probably not. Hedonism, secularism. They are global. And at our college, we are very concerned about understanding the modern media, especially popular culture. And we see that the countries we are sending missionaries to, they have exactly the same challenges. We've had the media or TV for quite a long time. But the countries we have missionaries in Tanzania, Kenya, South America and so on, their parents live in very simple conditions. Their young people are watching television, seeing the same movies that we do. So there's a big, big gap. And the young people, they're not enabled to understand and analyze this modern challenge. You know, Africa and South America and Asia is a place where the church is growing, exploding. But how are they going to deal with these global influences in some years? We need to be working globally as Christians to deal with the with these global factors of we could call modernization. We have pluralization, which is from being especially Europe a culture where Christianity was in the center. Now the culture has been set with many worldviews, many alternative lifestyles. Pluralization is one of the important characteristics of modern or postmodern society. So when you present Jesus, the questioner or the person you're talking to will immediately think, well, why Jesus? Why not Buddha, Quran, or whatever? Why Jesus? If you don't have a response to that question, well, why do we talk? And secularization is a very important thing. The it doesn't mean that the West has become un-Christian. The technical meaning of this world is that the religious ideas and institutions have lost their social or political influence. In some way, that could be seen as a good thing. The church is taken away from the state system, political system. In one way, other ways, it's maybe not as good. When the Christian ideas of human being, human value, of sexuality and marriage is put out in the margins of society. Okay? It's a challenge for us. And if we're a secular society, if you bring in religion, people are very uncomfortable, really emotionally. And we need that's why we talk in terms of worldviews at Gimler Column, because everyone has a worldview, secular or religious. We have privatization, which is one way of describing how the role of religion in modern secular society, because religion hasn't died. In the 60s, you know, the thinkers, the social analysts was thinking, well, it's going to be more secular, religion is going to die. It hasn't happened. Religious interest is, well, not exploding, but it's still there, and you see the programs of Spiritism on TV, very interesting. It's still there. But religion is seen as a private affair. It's a hobby. Either you go to sports, you go to church, you collect stamps, okay? It's your interest. It's your private interest. But don't pull everyone into your hobby. Not everyone likes stamps, do they? Okay? Private affair, that is the perspective people think when they think about Christianity and religion. It's a private affair. Secularization is the process of which new things are seen as sacred. Identity. Don't challenge my view of myself. Or especially in terms of sexuality, this is a sacred thing for me. Or nature. Something, say, where you find meaning, which gives an integration point for your whole worldview. And That is the second tool of sociology of knowledge, seeing how the world we live in shapes the way we, Christians and non-Christians, are thinking. That needs to be challenged and thought about. Okay. The third tool is the history of ideas. It's a more common way of understanding. You see, there are some histories, some worldviews and ideas that have influenced us. And I think these are a list of some of them. We need to understand them. And that's basically the list we've been teaching now at Gimler Cologne. Journalists need to know the different positions, and we need to hear them argued, and they need to know that, well, they can be argued. And I think the challenge for the church is partly that we have a crisis of identity. Coming from a culture that's been Christian, in Norway we have a state church now, there is a separation. Say, but who are we? Who is the state church? In one way, you come from the majority and you should be put down. On the other hand, if you come from a minority Christian group, you're suspicious, right? Dangerous with all these small sects. So who are we as Christians? There's a crisis of identity, of knowing who we are, and we also see a crisis of communication in the marketplace of worldviews. And my experience in the organization and across all the spectrum of the Christian Christian denomination and work, I feel the communication is very, very internal. You assume people are Christians, have the same view of the Bible and God, and you start from there when you preach. And even when you try to preach to non-Christians, you start with some Bible verses, and you wonder, why doesn't it work? So we are kind of culturally captive to a way of thinking. We also see an imbalance between the head, heart, and hand, where it's a lot about emotions, a lot about activity or justice. But the intellectual side is not really dealt with. And that is both the conservatives and the liberals. And you see a resistance to arguments. You become too intellectual, this too confrontational, people fearing the intellectual. I think we need to bring in apologetics, showing Jesus argued, showing all the letters, all the New Testament gives arguments. And we need to show that this really has to happen also on the basic level, not only at academic level. So we have a vision for apologetics in Europe, the importance of apologetics for the church to become more biblical, to become more holistic, to be more relevant to people. And showing that Christianity is not just a belief, a position, but it is the truth. But it needs people to argue it and show it.